This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Seymour Hersh with Amy Goodman, recorded in Santa Fe, New Mexico on 27 September 2006. Cy Hersh, the brilliant investigative journalist, has broken news stories that include the Abu Ghraib prison abuses, the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and the CIA's bombing of Cambodia. Here he tells stories of how he gathers his source material and offers his thoughts on the present and future in the Middle East before joining in conversation with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman.
Good evening. I'll only take a few seconds. I just want to say on behalf of the Lannan Foundation, the whole staff, the board of directors, I want to thank all of you in Santa Fe, all in this community for the support you give to this series. Makes it easy to keep doing it. And also I want to thank KSFR and KUNM for rebroadcasting these events. And I also want to thank the many people who come to our website where they can now get these events podcasted. Again, I think we're going to have a great season. We look forward to seeing you all many times. And I won't say any more. I don't think I have to introduce Amy Goodman, so here she is. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. Thank you, Patrick, and the Lannan Foundation. What a great honor it is to be here and to introduce Seymour Hersh. In order to do that, I'm going to talk about a person Seymour Hersh has never heard of, but it's an interesting story that I think, gives us a little insight into what Seymour Hersh does. Raed Jarrar, Iraqi architect who came to live in this country, was taking a flight from Kennedy Airport home to San Francisco. And as he got on the plane, or tried to, he was surrounded by JetBlue and TSA officials. And they told him he wouldn't be getting on the flight if he insisted on wearing his T-shirt. He said, "What's wrong with my T-shirt?" It was black and it had white letters that said, "We will not be silent." They said, "It's not the English words, it's the Arabic script above it." And he said, "Oh, that's just Arabic for 'we will not be silent.'" And they said, "We can't know that, we don't have a translator." And they said, "Wearing a T-shirt with Arabic script on an American plane today is like wearing a T-shirt that says, 'I am a robber,' and walking into a bank." The JetBlue official went and got Raed a T-shirt to cover up his own. I think it said something like New York or I love New York. Raed didn't want to be deported over this, and so he ultimately put on the T-shirt, and they escorted him onto the plane. He'd reserved one of the front seats long in advance, but they took him to the back of the bus, plane. And then the other passengers got on board, and he flew that way to San Francisco. And we told the story. Next day, a bunch of women came into our offices. All were wearing that T-shirt. And we asked, "Well, what are you doing?" They said, "We're getting to the airport as quickly as we can." I said, "Why are you going there?" They said, "Doesn't matter, we're just getting on planes." So, a couple days later, after this story got very big, one of those women came on. Her name was Lori Arbeiter, and she was the one who'd given Raed the original T-shirt. She was an artist against the war, and she did it on the anniversary of the invasion. Amazing to think we've been involved with Iraq longer than the U.S. has been involved with World War II. She said that they're doing a very brisk business now in T-shirts. Thousands of T-shirts they are selling, and they're translating it into all different languages, and now they're going to do it in the original German. Why German? Because it comes from World War II, the White Rose Collective, a brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, who thought, "What can we do in this face of atrocity?" And they started giving out pamphlets saying, "The least we can do is let Germans know so they can't say we didn't know." And they made a series of pamphlets. The fourth in the series at the bottom said, "We will not be silent." Hans and Sophie Scholl and the White Rose Collective were arrested. They were tried. They were sentenced to death, executed. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the motto, the Hippocratic Oath of the media today. We will not be silenced. And while I think the embedded process has brought the media to an all-time low in this country, there is one journalist who stands out. I'd say the premier investigative journalist of our day. And his name is Seymour Hersh. Unembedded, investigative, independent, unrelenting. And he has been for his whole career. He began as a reporter, then went to become press secretary of Eugene McCarthy. And then in 1969, as an independent reporter, as a freelancer, he exposed the My Lai massacre that helped to end the Vietnam War. The next year, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting, one of the few Pulitzer Prizes ever given out to an independent, a freelance journalist, not having the power, the institution, the resources of a major newspaper behind him. He did this with his own guts, intelligence, wits, persistence, and he has never stopped. He went on to write on and off for the New York Times. He, in 1975, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney tried to get the FBI to break into his house to find out where he was getting his information. Richard Perle, more recently, called Seymour Hersh the closest thing American journalism has to a terrorist. He has broken one story after another, from the My Lai massacre to, in 2004, the story of what was happening to prisoners at Abu Ghraib. In this country, most people maybe think of the statue of Saddam Hussein going down as the emblematic image of the war. But the rest of the world has a very different picture, perhaps an Iraqi soldier with a hood over his head, with an Iraqi prisoner with a hood over his head, arms out, Christ-like figure with electrodes dangling from his fingertips. And that's a terrible disparity, what Americans have, the image of the war, and what the rest of the world has. But I think Seymour Hersh is the journalist who is bridging that gap. Journalism is also about us understanding and communicating across borders. He exposed what was happening to prisoners in the photographs of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. He is more than an investigative journalist who, you know, exposes corruption in one government or another. And this goes to this issue of we will not be silent. Because he is a journalist with a very big heart. Yes, a massive brain, but a very big heart. And what these explosive exposés do is they also bring you the voices of those who cannot speak. In the case of the My Lai massacre, of course, it was the massacred Vietnamese civilians. In the case of the prisoners, the men who were imprisoned and brutalized at Abu Ghraib. That's what makes Seymour Hersh so great. He has written 8 books, and we'll talk about some of the subjects of those after in our conversation. His latest book is called Chain of Command, From 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. Seymour Hersh breaks the sound barrier with all of his work. Seymour Hersh helped to end the Vietnam War, and I'm convinced he'll be helping to end the war in Iraq, as well as one that may be planned, according to Seymour Hersh. His latest 2 major pieces in the New Yorker magazine. In one, Seymour Hersh reported the Bush administration had increased clandestine activities inside Iran and intensified planning for a possible major air attack. Hersh Sources told Hirsch that Air Force planning groups are drawing up lists of targets, and teams of American combat troops have been ordered into Iran undercover to collect targeting data and to establish contact with anti-government ethnic minority groups. One of the military's initial option plans, reported Seymour Hirsch, were calls for the use of a bunker buster tactical nuclear weapon against suspected underground nuclear sites. President Bush dismissed Seymour Hirsch, saying, "What you're reading is wild speculation." And his last piece, Seymour Hirsch writing about Israeli officials visiting the White House earlier this summer to get a green light for an attack on Lebanon. The Bush administration approved, Hirsch says, in part to remove Hezbollah as a deterrent to a potential U.S. bombing of Iran. Yes, reporting does make a difference when the reporter doesn't act as a conveyor belt for the lies of an administration. Seymour Hirsch, by exposing the lies, saves lives. Seymour Hirsch.
You're cutting into our time. Amy is not related to me, I promise you. And by the way, if you can't hear me at some point, just say something. I've given talks where afterwards people have come up to me and said they couldn't hear a thing I said. I know there's a mic, and I hope it works. We might as well get to the bottom line, and as I always do, let me just tell you that the bad news, which is there, by my count, there's 845 more days left in the reign of King George II. There is good news, and tomorrow morning when we wake up, there'll be one less day. But alas, I mean, that's the only good news you're going to get here. I promise you, I'm not selling. I don't have somebody in the back selling uppers, but this is not a good time. We had a great week last week. Last week was one of the more amazing weeks we had. We had the President of the United States spent basically a whole week publicly advocating for the right to torture and having a hissy fit when three Republicans, with the Democrats staying completely out of it in who knows what. My definition of Congress is the Senate anyway, is that on any given day they're either supine or prone, take your choice, but they're down. So the president spent a week advocating and sort of begging and pleading for the right to torture. And then we had Bill Clinton over the weekend to say, "By God, I want you to know that I was more willing to kill Osama bin Laden. I would have killed him more than George Bush ever dreamed of killing him. I wanted to kill that guy. It was amazing to watch it. Nobody wanted to kill him more than I did," he said. And so I don't know where we go from here, because we're not going to get much leadership on this issue. I don't know what's going to happen in Congress. I guess the Democrats will win. I don't know if it's going to make that much difference. I don't know if there's an exit plan that makes sense. There is an exit plan that makes sense to me, which is essentially nobody's been able to tell me that in Iraq, which is very difficult. It's a difficult situation. 150,000, 47,000 men. What they're doing is they're not adding more troops. They're just keeping people there for longer periods of time. You saw the other day, and they're going to try and probably get it over the 150 before the election in an effort to keep it down. But you can't keep it down because it's out of control. It's clearly, I don't have to tell you what it is. We don't have to talk about Afghanistan or Iraq here. We're just wasting time. We all know where it is and what's going on. But nobody's, in terms of getting out, sort of a complicated debate, how do you get out? The Democratic Party is just tongue-tied on this. Nobody talks about a moral issue. That's never on the table in America anymore. I don't know why. You heard mentioned that I worked for Gene McCarthy. McCarthy was by no means a radical. In any part of his soul, he was a Jesuit. He probably should have stayed in the seminary, in the sense that he was intellectually. I worked for him for a long time and really appreciate this enormous mind. And he was a difficult man, but where he came down was the war was a moral wrong. And he didn't want to make a big issue about it. He didn't like all this talking. He didn't like all these kids getting clean for Gene. He didn't think he had an obligation to them. He actually thought from an intellectual point of view, he didn't owe them anything. They weren't doing it for him. They were doing it, you know, for the war. And he was simply saying something. He was making a pointing about a moral issue. We don't hear that anymore from any leadership. Nobody talks about morality. In any case, nobody's told me that. Just trying to figure out how to get out of this mess. I talk to a lot of people inside. Obviously, one of the things I do is I have people that talk to me, and I am a mouthpiece for them, and I can't name them. And yes, I wish they'd go public. Yes, I wish some guy who spent 23 years trying to become a 3- or 4-star general would ruin his career by talking to me and be named, but I can't ask him to do that because that's the way it is today. They're not going to do it, but they don't like what's going on. But anyway, nobody can tell me that in 3 months it's going to be better in Iraq, or 6 months, or 9 months, or 1 year, or 2 years, or 3 years. And that therefore, it seems to me, we basically have two options on this war, and what to do about the war. Option one, get everybody out by midnight tonight. Option two, everybody out by midnight tomorrow night. And that's it. Now, but hold on. And it's complicated because, you know, cutting and running, all these issues come into effect. And what about our allies? What is going to happen? 2 years ago, I always thought that the 200 octane fuel that kept it going was us, from all sides. And 200 years ago, before the sectarian war became so acute, and this bloodbath that we see, and it's not necessarily driven by Al-Qaeda external forces. Most of the people on the inside will tell you it's a serious bloodbath between Sunnis and Shia, who have both gotten out of control. 2 years, one would have thought if we'd gotten out, the two sides, the main portions, the Sunnis and the Shia, would have somehow found a way to get together. There is oil there. The Middle East is a society that's instinctively mercantile. There's money to be made and a life to be led. And so you would have thought it's dicier now because it's spun so badly. And if you want to know something that always drives me crazy about the sectarian war we see, as bad as Saddam was, and he was bad, and there's no brief for Saddam, he did contain it. He put a lot of Shiite into the armed forces. And it was very interesting, if you go back and look at it, it was after Bremer, and Bremer's, you know, it's always easy to blame Bremer for everything. He's certainly at fault for a lot, but he just represented a point of view that was certainly at the White House endorsed. Bremer's idea was we were going to have the first election process they talked about after we won in the spring of 2003, when Bremer took over in May, June. We were going to have an election. They set up some sort of constitutional government where you're going to have representatives. And he then said, this was in the summer of 2003, the way we're going to do it is the people that are going to be invited to this new constitutional assembly will represent the percentage of people of the Sunni, Shia, and Kurds in Iraq. And if you go back and look at the newspapers, a lot of people said, what's this about dividing the government by percentage, the ruling people? Are they trying to start a civil war? The notion of sectarianism was really engendered innocently, I would say. Nobody had any intention of starting a civil war. In this blunderbuss, ignorant way we go about war, which is inevitable. I mean, it's no different than in Vietnam. I'm sure no different. War is war. I don't see any other option. I don't see what Stain's going to do to us. We're getting the 2,700 American boys, 58, you know, who knows how many thousands. And you know about this war, it's very tricky. Because Vietnam, the deaths right now are roughly, 3,000, 5% or so of what we had in Vietnam. We had 58,000. This disastrous war, but that war was always a tactical blunder. This is a strategic war. We put ourselves at war with the Muslim world. And I don't know how we're going to come out of it. I don't, without some changes. I'm going to read you something that was published just to show you, probably the most important person right now, certainly the brightest and the most revered person in the Middle East now is Nasrallah of Hezbollah, the leader of Hezbollah. And he gave a speech. The American press treat him as a caricature, which is a terrible misjustice because we should know what he's thinking. We should report what he says more completely. And he gave a speech the other day, and he talked before. You probably saw the photographs. It was on television. Half a million people, perhaps less, perhaps more, filled the. He spoke outdoors, although the Israelis have been saying publicly and privately to me, my Israeli friends have been saying, he's going to die. He can never appear in public again. He didn't speak in public, although he talked openly about the risks involved. And he wasn't sure he was going to go publicly, he said, until half an hour before he decided to do it. But he's telling this mass of people mostly Shia, but I'm sure some Sunni too. This is, and he's saying, he's just telling them about the war, and he says in the speech, as translated by the BBC, which makes it probably reasonably accurate, there's a lot of problems with translations from the Arab world, and a lot of crudity. But anyway, he describes how, and when the war against Hezbollah, when the war in southern Lebanon ended, he said, and he's more correct than most Americans want to know, because most Americans know because we're not being told by our press about it. He said, the Americans intervened and even accepted the draft, the end of the war, for the war to stop. It was an American decision. They stopped the war. That is, in the White House, it was decided the Israelis couldn't do it. We have to end. If you remember, when the war began, within minutes, George Bush was saying no ceasefire. No ceasefire, obviously. This wasn't a decision that was reached on the spur of the moment. Obviously, there was, obviously, and I wrote about it, and I'm baying in the wind on it, but I assure you that Lebanon, as I wrote, was a demo for some people in the White House, Cheney, et cetera, was a demo for what they want to do in Iraq. A lot of air, hit them hard, hit the infrastructure. Why bomb bridges 30 miles away from Hezbollah's stronghold? Why bomb all the bridges, the major bridges in Lebanon, particularly when that's a country controlled? Once you get away from, once you get into central Lebanon, it's controlled by an ally. The Sinjar government is our ally. Why bomb all the roads? Because in the White House's view, it's a message for Iran. They should know what we're willing to do, what we're willing to help the Israelis do. And this will eventually get out. But anyway, here's Nasrallah talking. And he said, they stopped the war, the Americans stopped the war, not for the sake of Lebanon, not for the sake of the children of Lebanon, not for the sake of the blood of women in Lebanon, not for the sake of beautiful Lebanon. They stopped the war for the sake of Israel. And right or wrong, this is what he's telling people. We sometimes differ. We sometimes ask, what happened in what happened in Lebanon? This is a speech before 500,000 people. What happened in Lebanon, victory or defeat? I do not want to go into semantics, but I tell you, whoever feels that his option, plan, line, and vision has triumphed, it feels the victory and speaks about it. Whoever feels he's been defeated and has fallen speaks about the defeat. We feel we've won. Our victory is not the victory of a party. It is not the victory of a community. It is a victory for true Lebanon, true Lebanese people, etc., etc. This victory, he goes on, is too big to be comprehended by us. The next weeks and months will determine, will confirm this. Then he goes on a couple pages later and he says today, he's telling those people who supported his resistance, as he puts it, and you do understand that Israel did not do what it did in response to the capture of two soldiers. I'm sure they were offended by it. I'm sure Nasrallah himself has said publicly he's sorry he did it because of the response, but this had been planned in advance. They were going to hit the next time Nasrallah crossed the line, they were going to hit him big, with a lot of active planning with America. And he says, today, he says, he's talking to the Arab world, the Sunni and Shia world. Your resistance broke the image of Israel. We have done away with the invincible army. We've also done away with the invincible state. Indeed, we have done, I'm not exaggerating or voicing slogans. It is enough for you to read what is going on in occupied Palestine. It is then saying it's time to start doing something about Palestine. What's happened right in front of our eyes, with whether it's a defeat or a stalemate, the Israelis don't want to acknowledge the extent of the defeat, but public opinion in Israel, I think Omar, the prime minister, is at 7% and going nowhere. And they'll probably dump Peretz, the defense minister. They'll keep him in the coalition because he needs the Labor Party in it to keep keep on ruining. He doesn't want another election. What we've gone to is an understanding in the Arab world that if they organize and that if they do it right and they work hard, they can maybe take on Israel. They can maybe do something about Palestine. That's what Nasrallah is advocating. He's saying we've got to move and start doing something about what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza. And it's a different world out there now. The people I talk to in Washington, the people I talk to in the government, and there, as you know, there are terrific people. There should be. There is, you know, I really never met anybody in 40-some-odd years of reporting who thought he was a bad person. People don't think that way about themselves. There are a lot of people in the government who are really good, very serious, that do what they do, that love America. They're staying in. They don't know what to do. They're trying to do what they can to stem this tide of what's going on in the White House. And we're really at a very critical point in terms of how we're going to deal with the Arab world, because right now they have learned something. They have learned they can win. That the old days of being overrun and being cowering before the Israelis and worrying about what they were going to do are gone. I think the implications are enormous. It's a change that is rarely discussed, and it's a change that means that what we should be doing in a rational world is we should be talking faster and quicker than ever, not only to the Iranians. If you don't want to talk to Ahmadinejad, you can talk to the Khomeini, the ruler, the spiritual leader, who probably has an awful lot of influence, certainly much more in the nuclear weapon than Ahmadinejad. You can certainly talk to the Syrians. The president of Syria gave an interview last weekend to Der Stern, the German weekly, which is a great, they've got an English webpage. It's really worth looking at, too, when you go online, and which he's basically begging for somebody to come talking. And what did Ahmadinejad, what has he been saying in his public comments? Yes, he says stupid, idiotic things about the Holocaust, and he says a lot of taunting things, but he also says, treat us like we're Iranians. We've been in existence for, you know, Persia, Cyrus the Great. Treat us with dignity, and we will deal on any issue. And I could also, I have written this. I will tell you right now, nobody can prove a negative, but there is no active intelligence in the American intelligence system and in our allies. And I'm doing more writing about this journalistically. There's no evidence of a significant nuclear weapons program in Iran. That doesn't mean they don't have a dream. It doesn't mean that they might not have something secret. There is no positive evidence. Therefore, if you do Iran, you're going to have a hell of a time acquiring targets. And you're going to have to go beyond the normal stuff. You can't, you know, the problem we have. I use the word cult, cult sometimes about these guys. What did happen in America is that after the election of 2000, after 9/11, when America was scared, frightened, nervous, wanted to do something, the neocons took over. Essentially, I use the word cabal, that's the word they use, but people find that to be anti-Semitic, so I'll back off cabal, cult, if you will. 8 or 9 people took over this government and moved it in a direction that contrary to every direction we'd ever gone, preemptive war, changing all of the rules of conduct, and, you know, not only in terms of cooperation internationally on international agreements, global warming issues and other issues, human rights issues, but also just generally across the board, reversing policy. And the way it came across to me how bad things were is before the war in Iraq, there was an army general named Shinseki. Remember Shinseki? He was from Hawaii. And he testified in February, I think, before one of the congressional committees, the Armed Services Committee, I think, is my memory. He said, well, the White House, Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and others in the Pentagon, and were all saying that we could win this war. Essentially, their argument was, oh, some special forces, a few bombs, a lot of American flags, some propaganda, you know, 5,000-10,000 troops go in, and Saddam will fall, and democracy will flow like water, and it'll spread from Iraq into Iran, into Lebanon, into Syria, and it'll be a whole new world in the Middle East. That was what they were advocating internally and externally. And Shinseki says, well, actually, he says in response to a question, we really should have at least 250,000 troops, something like that, 200,000 or 300,000 troops. And there was immediate outrage in the White House. Wolfowitz denounced him, and Rumsfeld even, if some of you might remember, this is 03, he was due to be chief of staff of the year of the Army. Remember the Joint Chiefs for another year. Rumsfeld announced his successor a year early. General named Keane, Jack Keane. John Keane was going to replace him a year early. In other words, it was the gravest of insult. He was going to be, what's the cliche? What's the word for somebody who's not in office anymore? Lame duck. And by the way, the word lame duck, you just wait to 207. You know, when we have this president no longer worrying about having to worry about the Republicans. He's going to be in office in 207 for 2 more years. I'll tell you, that's when I'm scared. I'm scared after November. That's when I'm really going to be worried because, you know, he can't come back again against unconstitutional. This is one shot. And whether he's doing it for God, to revenge his father, or whatever, he's going to be really a handful in 2007. And whether there's the Democrats in the Congress or not, whether they control a member of the House. But anyway, Shinseki. The wonderful thing about the general is a year later, when Shinseki retired, Keane didn't take the job. Nobody, it was one of those little factoids that everybody missed. He retired. He just wouldn't do it. I presume that's why he retired. I mean, he wouldn't do it. He didn't take the job. They brought in an outsider. But in any case, so Shinseki, they were enraged at Shinseki. And one of the guys on the inside, I talked to some of these guys. These guys meet once a month. They have their little Aristotelian club and they talk about the Socratic readings and they have external readings on the they're great scholars on the Greek mythology and the Greek writers. And they have their meetings. They're very They're all, you know, the cliche we use is Straussians. Claremont College is very strong among these guys, but they are very bright and articulate. And one of them said to me, you have to understand why they were so mad at Shinseki. It wasn't because he talked about big numbers. It was, didn't he get it? Hadn't he been at all those meetings in the tank where the Joint Chiefs and the President and Rumsfeld all sit and discuss the war? All those meetings in the tank where we told him, we're going to take down Saddam with 5,000, 10,000 troops. Hadn't he heard it? It was like he said he had been in a cult he'd run into a deprogrammer. He'd been deprogrammed out of a cult. That was their attitude. My God, and the first time I got a real sort of a working sense, this was a casual conversation afterwards, and I began, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's like that old Kevin McCarthy movie, the people in the pods, we've been taken over. And, you know, the tragedy of it is, the tragedy is how fragile our democracy turns out to be. A bunch of guys come in with a lot of talk, a lot of braggadocio, and how weak we turn. How, you know, what about it? Where are the Jeffersonians? What about the First Amendment? It's how quietly and easily we went down is very troubling, and we should all worry about it. I don't want to get into isms, but we're in trouble. And I don't know how, I don't know who's going to lead us out of it. The Republicans, I'm sure, will have a great campaign slogan. You know, it'll be, do you want Congress run by Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid? And they'll probably get some traction. Who knows? Where the Democrats are in all of this, they've simply stepped aside, and we can talk about that forever, but I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer where Carl Levin, who's so bright from Michigan, who understands, the second-ranking man of the Senate Armed Services Committee, really a bright guy, very knowledgeable. Why he isn't putting it out there, I don't know why somebody can't decide this is a moral issue. Let's just do it. But it doesn't happen. So we struggle along here, all of us, trying to make sense of our country. So I could, you know, I have to tell you one thought. The president, I was reading the Times today, about he's having a fit about, you know, I used to joke about him early on when he first became president because, you know, he was talking all this rebel talk, and I used to say, joke that he was a rebel with a bedtime. And he's, in speeches, I used to make fun of him. But this is really pretty menacing now. But anyway, there's nothing worse than a dedicated, true revolutionary. A completely committed revolutionary, a true radical in every sense, with no sense of right and wrong, of balance, no ability to change his mind, no ability to be taken off, to change a viewpoint, no ability to be educated. I commend all of you if you want to know all you need to know about what happens when the intelligence community, the honorable guys, try and speak to these guys in the White House. The classic thing was Tim Russert's interview with Cheney. Russert would say something, you know, state of fact, the polls show 60% of the public is troubled by the war. Oh, Tim, he said, I don't buy that. And so you go to a meeting and you say, well, sir, we can't really find any physical evidence of an active parallel, that is, secret nuclear program in Iran. Although I can tell you, we have really tried. Really, really, really tried. And we can't find any, and the answer, of course, is, oh, I don't buy it. We're going to go ahead. So when you're dealing with this, it's almost like, I don't know, somebody, a foreign minister, one of our European colleagues, once said to me, he was talking about Wolfowitz, and he said, oh God, the guy's, he's a Trotskyite, he believes in permanent revolution, then spent weeks calling me up and begging me never to say that, never to say he said it. So worried that somebody would say it. So anyway, so here's the president. And there's this NIE that came out, and, you know, I'm glad the New York Times did it, and I'm glad the other papers picked it up. The idea that somehow it's news to any of us, that's what's gone on, it's created terrorism. And I think the story could have sort of dealt with the fact that the report's out, it's great we did it, but the fact is that very few people will be surprised by what it says. And then here's Bush yesterday trying to say, well, it didn't say what it said. I used to tell when I gave speeches a couple of years ago a lot, I used to tell the great Richard Pryor joke. And somebody later told me he wasn't the originator, but so what, I heard him do it in Chicago many years ago. He was doing one of his bits, and is he late? He died. The late Richard Pryor. One of the bits is, his wife goes to work and he's home doing his wife's best friend in their bed, and she comes home unexpectedly early in the day and sees him, right? She starts screaming and he jumps up and he puts a sheet around him, and he starts saying, and there's a lot of screaming and yelling. Finally he says to her, "Look," he says to his wife, "are you going to believe me or your lying eyes?" And so I'm reading the paper today, and I saw the paper, what the president's trying to explain this NIE, and saying, you know, my God, would he be laughing? I actually started with Groucho Marx, apparently, somebody told me later. How to take it beyond that. Let me just take a few minutes and tell you a little history about responsibility and chain of command and the issue of prisoners and torture. I think I can say categorically that the 14 prisoners the president is talking about, colleague Sheikh Mohammed is being returned to Gitmo. First of all, Guantanamo's become a tougher base now, so I understand. I mean, anecdotally, just from lawyers who deal with people, it's gotten much tougher. If you don't remember, they're force-feeding people. And, of course, we do tend to describe it. Somebody once said they have a better life there. It was Rumsfeld, I think, who always says everything. They had a better life there than they did in their home back in, you know, the desert, wherever they are, you know, tending goats or whatever. I mean, they get 3 square meals a day and, you know, all the tubes they want put down them if they don't eat. Anyway, I don't know. I actually looked at it. I didn't write the stuff because a lot of stories in the newspaper business is tough. I have a lot of stories that have three pair. One of the things I always tell colleagues in the press corps is that they always run a lot of stories that are tips. They'll get a good piece of information and they won't do enough with it. So they end up working on it for 3 or 4 days and they just write it as a tip. And so you get stuck in a certain story where it's he said, she said. So I get into that a lot. And a lot of the work I do, I spin my wheels an awful lot. But Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was not a reliable source for us. They've done a lot of, you know, he was the guy captured very early in Pakistan. And he gave us, he was programmed, and obviously the in their own literature, Al-Qaeda, and we've captured their working manuals. They understand from 97 on, some they've been telling their people in various manuals that we captured, some of which we captured only after we invaded Afghanistan. They said that they're going to be undressed, you're going to be stripped, you're going to be humiliated, you're going to be subjected to the worst kind of tortures. And you have to know what you're doing before you go in. You have to be ready. And he spun out. He gave us one wonderful early story about something that we stopped. And then he gave us all kinds of other stories that we spent enormous energy on, all of which were wrong. He was a dissembler, a deceiver. He was very well trained. I mean, he was willing to die for his cause. And so it's very hard to get those people to crack and break. And the intelligence we've gotten, basically my friends describe it as a thimbleful of useful stuff out of most of the guys. First of all, we still torture. We haven't stopped torturing. You don't know all the prisons that exist. I'm not trying to be coy. I'll just tell you there are more prisons that we don't know about that haven't been reported. He's not going to give up the ghost of torture. Although everybody, as you know, the military officers themselves, the JAG officers all tell you it doesn't work, it doesn't work, it doesn't work. This administration is not going to budge off it. Not going to budge off it. The legislation, the McCain legislation that was passed last Christmas really didn't stop anything. It didn't have any bite. And when the president says that there's going to be special CIA people and special units that conduct special interrogation with special rulings and special abilities they have, they can go farther than others. The reality is, in the world of interrogation, in the military world of interrogation, in the intelligence world of interrogation and interrogation, the simple way to describe it, and this is the words used by somebody involved, one size fits all. Once anybody begins the waterboarding and other extreme measures, everybody learns what they do. And that becomes the baseline, a baseline. You can't segregate it into some small units because it's a word-of-mouth community. The interrogation community. And the other thing that always knocks me out about it, about torture, is I learned about Abu Ghraib very early. I'm just thinking about how to put it. After the war, I made contact with a lot of Iraqi generals who worked for Saddam, who did not support Saddam, but many were in serious positions and had left the military, were trying to make a life selling oranges or doing what they could on the side. Many had to stay in the country. In one case, one two-star general that was deeply involved in very sophisticated Iraqi intelligence had a daughter in med school, and she was in her second or third year, and she knew Arabic. She didn't know another language, and he had to stay there, he thought, to get her through med school. Seems silly now when you think about the notion of any sort of systematic schooling going on, although they're trying. I mean, education is a huge value. And so I would see people in 02 and 03. The reason I hesitate is I don't like talking about what I do so much. I would go see people in the Middle East. They would come to Syria. They would come to other countries. And in those years, you could get out. And people would talk to me about what was going on, what had gone on before we invaded, went on afterwards, what the Americans were doing. And there was a lot. And so around December of 03, a senior general who did not like Saddam, but who was still living in Baghdad because that was his life. He couldn't envision many of them, as you know, anybody who could get out now has gone. Jordan, 400,000 or 500,000 probably families of people, not families, 400,000 or 500,000 people have moved into Damascus. Real estate prices, they're out of sight. They go there. They've gone to Jordan. They're driving the market up all over. Anybody can get out gets out now. By now, most of them, anybody not committed to one cause or another in the Sunni world anyway, not so much in the Shia world because they have much to gain there, has gotten out. So he was telling me, we were talking, I had a notebook after notebook, and you know, we're 4 days in a hotel of talking 12 hours a day, tell me everything. And I'm just taking notes because you never know what's going to be important. And when they turned to Abu Ghraib, this is, I say, December maybe of 03, Abu Ghraib stories, I didn't write those stories till next spring. They were in May in the New Yorker. CBS also had a big touch of it, too. They ran some photographs. He told me then, and it's one of those things you just never forget. He said, we started turning to the prison system. He said, well, Abu Ghraib's really unbelievable. And I said, why? He said, well, because there's a lot of women and children there, mothers and daughters. There's a whole many thousands, hundreds of them, separate wings. And they're all writing home to their fathers and brothers to please come kill him because they've been defiled. And I do a double take. What do you, in that culture, you know, that if you're what an American GI would call grab ass would be enough to shame somebody, a young woman that hasn't been engaged and, or a mother, a wife that's never been seen by nobody but her husband seen him. It's this incredible. And so after that, I got into it. I began to poke around. And doing a lot of talking, I never heard about rules or regulations until after the story got out. All of a sudden, we're flooded. Army regulations, rules. Nobody ever said there's rules. It was, come on, bad guys. You do what you do to bad guys. Look, it's one person. It's anecdotal. I'm not saying it's systematic. I'm not saying there weren't rules promulgated. But rules were not on anybody's minds. In talking to people about the prison system, that just never came up. It's just how far do you go? What can you do? What can you get away with? I would suggest to you that it's probably worthy. It's going to be a congressional investigation, but somebody ought to seriously look at what would happen in one of these secret CIA prisons if, as often happens, they got the wrong guy. Because there was so much confusion about names, particularly early on in the war. We had a lot of problem with Arabic names. As you know from all the stories you read about people trying to get through the TSA system, they would have a name that sounded familiar, and Omar and Abdullah's, et cetera. So suppose 2 or 3 weeks into the captivity of somebody you thought was a high-ranking guy, you discovered he had the wrong name. What do you think happened to him? Well, it's not pretty. Again, it's anecdotal, and I don't have a camera. I don't have a video of it, as we did at Abu Ghraib. So, the war begins. Let me tell you this story. I've got 10 minutes. I'm looking at a clock here. 12:56. I'm counting it down. Let me take you through the Abu Ghraib. I think I can do it quick. Most of it you know. The war begins, March. We begin with, by the way, major bombing and an attempt to assassinate Saddam. Bill Clinton had tried it in December of 98. We missed. At that point, in decapitation bombing by the Air Force, after the failure to get Saddam in March of 07, remember, March of 03, remember the war began, we thought we killed him, those couple of days of that. We were 0 for 7 in decapitations, the Air Force at that point. Israel's now 0 for 1. They, on the first day of the war in southern Lebanon, they thought they had Nasrallah. And they were saying, we got him, he's injured, he's dead, we got him. They were absolutely convinced they had intelligence, they had him. Should have told them something about the quality of intelligence they had. Sandbag totally. Sandbag utterly, totally. Whether this is an accepted reality by this White House or not, that their perception of the war, as I think you'll find out, is probably a lot different than anybody else's. But in any case, so we start the war, and in early April, if you remember, we march into Baghdad, and it's over. We win. No opposition in Baghdad. A couple of days earlier, and not much comment in the press about what happened. We were going to have door-to-door fighting. Saddam's, you know, we expected to go, and it was going to be a bitter, bitter, bitter war. What happened? There was never any in the hoopla about the war. The statue fell down. The president lands on May 1st. Well, what happened is, and the intelligence community knows, is that long-standing plans, basically, some of you know something about the history of the region following the tactics of the Dawa Party, which was the only group inside Iraq, Iranian sponsor, that was able to take a shot at Saddam, hit his kids once. One of the boys fired at him and got one of them in a car. They were the only people in real opposition. Every time you captured a Dawa Party member, he knew nothing but three people. And Saddam was impressed by that. So what my friends tell me, the ones I talk to, who were inside and who had paper about all this, was that there was pretty elaborate planning for a guerrilla operation, because the assumption was they weren't sure we'd come, but it looked like we were going to come. They took Bush seriously. This notion that everybody thought they had bombs and Saddam hadn't told them is so irrational. Saddam told us repeatedly he didn't have bombs. He did a 12,000-word statement to the UN in December of 2002, which was the White House considered to be the absolute defining issue that proved he was lying. When, of course, that's probably one of the more honorable papers written in terms of, certainly in terms of what the White House was saying about WMD, weapons of mass destruction. In any case, so the community, NSA, our signals community, noticed on around 6th to 7th, the photographs overhead showed that on every major street corner off the main drags, there were gun emplacements. Saddam had a couple of special units. One of them was the SSO, people that guarded him, special Republican guards, people that he had trusted. We're talking 6,000-8,000 people. They were dug in, anti-personnel. They had machine guns in corners, sandbags, all over the place. They all melted away overnight, along with the bureaucracy, the senior leadership of the Ba'ath Party, the guys who ran the hospitals, the guys who ran the bureaucracies, the guys who ran the ministries. Not the worker bees, the guys, I'm talking about the guys on top, the guys who ran the waterworks, the guys who ran the oil works. The guys who ran the federal, as I say, most of the government ministries that controlled federal documents and et cetera, disappeared. There's a huge migration out of there, 7, 8, 9. By the time we go in, the third division, the American 3rd Division goes in, there's no opposition. Victory is ours. We celebrate it. We're all happy. Very few casualties. There was no question about it. Many people in Baghdad were overjoyed. In the summer, early summer, we start seeing activity against our forces by the insurgency. Rumsfeld calls them dead-enders. Just a bunch of 5,000 dead-enders. Just guys who just don't get with it. You know, we're doing everything. And meanwhile, we'd started this search and destroy tactics that a general named General Sanchez, who was a 3-star general operating with the instincts of a lieutenant colonel, you know, he was so over his head, and he would, you know, the model was in Vietnam. You break into somebody's house, you go running through the house, you search through it, you pull out any mail, you take them and you throw them away, whatever you do. And it's just the violence that we were engendering was creating members of the insurgency too. We began to see more sophisticated operations against us in the sense that guys would stand up and our boys would open up, there'd be a firefight, and then the people, the American units that would come to support our guys, the relief groups, or the rescue teams, the helicopters and tank units that would run in relief would get ambushed big time because the opposition clearly knew how we responded to an attack. So we saw that. And so in August of 2003, UN is blown up. The Jordanian embassy is blown up. And inside the American government, that was really big because the Jordanian embassy is where the Israeli Mossad works with us and the Jordanian colleagues. There's 1.4 million Iraqi Jews, many of them, all of them, basically out. Maybe 20,000 or so were left by the time that Saddam got in. And by 91 anyway, most of them were out. And many were still left in, you know, the generations were in Israel. Their language skills were great. They moved in and out with great ease. But the Jordanian embassy was where they would work. Getting hit was a message to us that people sort of knew what we were doing. Waterworks got hit pretty hard. Not only got hit in places that indicate transfer points, that indicate people who maybe had the master plans. The same with some of the oil. Pumping stations were hit in ways that the charge came at just the right spot to cause the most damage, as if somebody who actually knew something about the waterworks and the oil works were working for the resistance or the insurgency or the dead enders. September of 2003, panic in the White House. It's a year before the election. They don't want, this insurgency is bothering me more than they admit. We've got to get better intelligence. General Miller comes from Gitmo, tells everybody how to soup it up. They begin to really start working the people at Abu Ghraib. They're going to start really getting tougher. The fun and games we saw about the photographs begin. That starts September, October, November, goes on for 3-4 months. In January, one of the kids inside finally has it with it. Has a sense of morality, outrage, moral outrage, tells the authorities about it, shows them the discs that are all over the unit, various units that are there. There was no secret about what was going on, the kind of humiliation, sexual humiliation. And an investigation begins. And here's where the chronology gets interesting. What I'm telling you now comes from Rumsfeld's public statements after the stories I did in the New Yorker and CBS. The CBS photographs came out. Rumsfeld has some briefings and he gives some statements. By the end of January, a general named Taguba, very honorable guy, Antonio Taguba, born in the Philippines, begins an investigation, and it's going to be tough. And it's very tough, and he's doing it. And the Pentagon, Rumsfeld gets a briefing sometime before the end of the month, January, that it's not good. He doesn't want to see anything. Doesn't want to see the photographs. On the 22nd, of January, this is now testimony, and now this is in testimony. May testifies with C-SPAN and public television. It was big news. This was after the stories came out. On the 2 days after he got a briefing, I think it was late January, he tells the president about it, and we go on. February, March, April, they're doing what they do, and I start writing these stories in late April, The president immediately announces he's against torture, et cetera, big issue. Rami goes to the hearings. Again, remember, he's told about it in late January, and what does he do? 2 days later, he tells the president of the United States, I'm watching this. I wish I could tell you I thought about it right away. I thought about it pretty quickly, but what a story. The president of the United States was briefed about Abu Ghraib in late January, and what did he do about it? Nada. Nothing. Did he say, Rumsfeld, what's going on here? This is intolerable. Did he demand an investigation? Did he want to see the generals? Did he want a complete shakeup of what's going on? This kind of stuff is I had an Israeli friend of mine, a Mossad friend. I mean, we're talking about a really tough guy. He called me up after I did those stories and he said, Hirsch, he said, I hate Palestinians and they hate me. And I have done terrible things to them and they would do terrible things to me. And we've done terrible things to them in prison. And they've done terrible things to us. But let me tell you something. He said, we're talking about fingers and eyes. He said, we know that sometime we're going to have to live with those no good, awful things. We're going to have to live with them and share a border, whether there's a wall there or not. This is when we thought the wall could work. The Israelis thought it could work. And he said, let me tell you something. You idiots, what you did, sexual humiliation to an Arab, do you understand? The photographs, you have made it impossible to live with them. If we had done that, and I'm telling you, we do bad things. If we had done that, photographed naked men, women going up and down, simulating masturbation, simulating homosexual acts, he said, we could not even think about sharing a border with them, no matter how bad things are. You guys don't know what you did, and we don't. And here's the President of the United States, right there telling us, Rumsfeld tells us he knew 3.5 months before it became known. And you want to know about chain of command? I'm not saying he knew about Abu Ghraib, the photographs beforehand. But once he knows, it's there, it's in the record. So two quick stories. When I did the My Lai story, one of the things I did, I was running around, I got heard of the story, and I was chasing it down. And I was left untouched by reporters. I wrote 5 pieces for a little anti-war news service called the Dispatch News Service that became huge. That's still the great thing about America. And by the way, you're talking to somebody who I got money to go to school. I came from a lower middle class family in Chicago. Harvard, Yale, you got to be kidding. I worked my way through school. I had to work during school, even though I had a scholarship, I had to pay. And I get out of college, and 11 years after graduating, not the editor of any 11 years after graduation, I'm sticking two fingers in the eye of Richard Nixon over Mealy and getting awards and more money than I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, that's, you know, you're talking to somebody who does. I'm never going to give up in this country because we can come to deal with it. In any case, I do the story. And eventually, after running, doing some stories, I hear about a kid named Medlo. And what happened that day was, as some of you don't remember, they went into a village, a group of kids. They had toked it up and they had drank it up. The kids did dope and the officers and sergeants did booze. And they all got together and they were going to go see the enemy the next day. This was in the spring of March of 69. They'd been in the country for 3 months, had seen nobody. Like our troops, had been fired, had been booby-trapped, had been killed by, you know, snipers, like our troops. You can understand the rage of the population. And you can. I mean, it's a part and parcel of war. You dehumanize the other people. Of course you do. How else can you cope? You don't see an enemy. And so these guys went and they expected to see the major North Vietnamese battalion. They were scared to death and said there was 550 is the number. Women, children, old men and women making breakfast. They rounded them up in three ditches and began to execute them. And executed them all day. At one point, at a critical moment, they stopped and they had meal. God, some guy's taking photographs of it. And all the generals are on top of it. I wrote two books about it. One about the cover-up that nobody cared about, but I did. And about everybody knew. Everybody knew what happened. I think more reporters than want to admit. And so at one moment, after they'd shot everybody in the ditch, M1s, I think it was, 16 clips, some mother had tucked a kid under her stomach. And this kid somehow, you know, a mother, and at the bottom of a ditch, somehow they heard her keening, and this kid began to crawl full of blood. And he got to the top of the pile, and he began to run across the field, the paddy, whatever it is. And Lieutenant Calley, the infamous Calley, who was blamed, he became the sort of focal point for all the rage and anger about this. Calley went to a kid named Paul Medlow, a farm kid from New Goshen, Indiana. And he said, who'd been shooting, one of those shooting? The Hispanic and black kids shot high, most of them, not all of them, many shot high. And they all wore armbands. They didn't want to not shoot. I talked to 58 of the 60 or 80 kids who were there over the next year. And the minority kids said, there's no way we're not going to shoot because, you know, if we're not shooting, somebody's going to shoot us the next day. We knew that. So we shot high. You know, it's not our war. So, but Medlow, this farm kid, Callie, had shot clip after clip, seven or eight clips. He later said six, seven clips. And Callie goes to him and says, plug him. And he couldn't do it. So Callie took a carbine. Officers had smaller rifles, and he ran behind him. Everybody remembered this. And plugged him, shot him in the back of the head. And the next day, Medlow, walking, they're on patrol. And he steps on a landmine and blows off his leg, and he starts this screaming this curse. I heard about it. It was repressed memory. I was 3 weeks into this story, running around the country. I'd written already a couple of pieces before one of the kids told me about it. I was interviewing kids at the unit. Most of them were back home. And then once I went back and called everybody else knew the story. Nobody had told it to me. And he began screaming, God had punished me, Callie. God's going to punish you. God had punished me, Callie. And everybody said, get that chopper. Get him out of here, the R&R chopper. And so finally the chopper came and took him away. And I started looking for him. He lived in Indiana. This was the day before Google and all the stuff you have now. I mean, we're talking about a lot of phone calls. I had no money. I had an American Express card that I was using to fly around. I kept on thinking these ads, you know me with this American Express card? I broke the Mealy Massacre. I don't think so. Don't think so. They never asked. Anyway, so I finally found the family, Medlow family, New Goshen, Indiana. I call up and I get the mother, this rural voice that's near the Ohio River, south of something, which is south of Indiana, which is south of Chicago. South of Indianapolis, south of some other city, south of Chicago, way nowhere. And so I was in Salt Lake City, and I flew all night, got down to Indianapolis, got a car, went down there. This is before MapQuest. Finally found the house. It's a chicken farm. And this is not Norman Rockwell, you know, the Saturday Evening Post that some of us grew up with, you know, serene rural life. This was scrappy, no man around. Chickens running around, no fencing, dirt poor. And I pull it, and I talked to the mother the day before, and I said, I'm a reporter. I want to come talk to your son. She said, I don't know. You know, I said, I'm coming. She said, well, I can't tell you what he's going to do. He doesn't talk much to anybody. I said, I'm coming. So the next day, I pull in my ratty suit, little briefcase, and I got to get out of my car. And she comes out, and she's whizzing. She's probably 50, looks 70. And there's a little ramshackle house, and I said, "Are you Mrs. Meadlow?" And I introduced myself, and I said, "Can I talk to him?" She said, "He's in there." And then she said, "I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer." Right? So flash forward, 35 years. I'm doing Abu Ghraib. I'll make this in 2 more minutes. I'm doing Abu Ghraib, and I'm doing 3 stories in 3 weeks. And you don't know anything about the New Yorker, that's like the end of the world. You can't do it because they have fact-checking. The last person that you deal with when you're closing a story is the grammarian who's worrying about parallelism. A lot of worry about parallelism. And a lot of debate, you know, it's a lot of comma stuff is really arbitrary. So there's a lot of... Well, what, you know, you're closing a piece, I'm exhausted, this is the third piece in 3 weeks, and they're having a debate, the editor, about whether we need another comma. Anyway, but it you know, something, you gotta respect the process. It's an amazing process, and it's a great process. I wish everybody did it. It's exhausting, but it's quite astonishing. Nobody I talk to, anybody who talks to me, anybody on the inside understands they have to talk to a New Yorker fact checker, and they have to trust me enough to do it. And they do. It's been over, some of these people I've known for 20 years. It seems amazing to most people. But, you know, America's full of people, even on the inside in the most sensitive places, with enormous integrity. And they respect the system, and they respect the fact that it protects them in a way. You know, they can change a phrase that maybe they said something at a meeting the day before. In any case. So I'm one of the things I do when I do these stories for the New Yorkers, I go do interviews and stuff like that. I always talk to Amy, whether I want to or not. Anyway, and so I'm on some NPR show talking about the story, and I get a call. This is after week two, and I get a call from a woman who calls up and says, on air, I'll fudge because Northeast America, you're not going to find her, but somewhere in, I have a child that was in the unit, and nobody will talk to. I can't get any reporter, and I've really trouble about something that's going on. And I said, they're on the air. I just one of those snap decisions. I said, get a pencil, and I said, 202. I wrote on it. Gave my number out. Got a lot of crazy calls the next couple of days. Not that many, because people, they kept on calling the station wanting the number because they didn't write it down. You don't sit there listening to the radio with a pencil. But she called me 2 days later, and I flew up to see her and a relative. We met in a restaurant. And here's the story. She had a kid in the unit that did the horrible stuff. And she was a young girl, and she came back from the unit early. They were all sent home. And she didn't know anything except the child came back differently. Depressed, upset, wanting no contact. She was a reservist in a reserve unit, had gone over for a year, been called up to duty, had just been married, leaves her husband, leaves the family, gets a night job somewhere else, doesn't want to see anybody. Nobody can figure out anything. Abu Ghraib comes out, this big picture. She goes and knocks on the door. The young lady opens the door, and she shows her the photograph. Slam, no communication. This is, you know, there's always an ethical issue for a journalist, too, because you're talking about somebody potentially suicidal. And how much do you intervene? These are other collateral issues that get into it. You know, as a journalist, how much can you intervene? Because I also want something from her. Can it be quid pro quo? And I maybe you don't know what I'm talking about, but I do. I think about this stuff a lot, about how far I can intervene in somebody's personal life, particularly when I want something from them. It's always complicated. And it should be. It always isn't. Anyway, at this point, this woman this is not somebody who's hugely big on self-awareness. We're not talking about somebody who's read Freud. She claimed that at that time, she realized the kid had gone with a computer. And what they did in this war is all the people that went to serve in reserve units and regular units, many of them, if the family could afford it, they got a portable computer with a CD player so they can watch movies. Which I never occurred to me, but that's true. I now know that's very common. So she gave her, and when the kid came back, among the things she did is she dumped off the computer. At that point, she said she decided she wanted to take the computer for a second computer in her office. I think it was more than that, but she doesn't, anyway, it doesn't matter. So she opened up the computer and she started erasing files, and there's a file called Iraq, and she hit the file. Out comes 80 digital pictures. If you remember, the New Yorker ran an iconic photograph of a naked Iraqi man, prisoner, outside the prison. Naked, and two snarling Belgian shepherds, not German shepherds necessarily. We had a big debate about what they were. Two dogs about three feet away on each side snarling. And in the sequence, the dog attacked the man. And the man, by the way, couldn't even do what anybody would at that moment, protect his private parts. He had to keep him behind his head. The dog did attack him, and it included a lot of blood, a lot of other stuff, a lot of horrible stuff. We decided, and I think it was a great decision, we're not going to run the whole sequence, not because we're protecting the U.S. Army, because how much can you do to the Arab man? How much can you do? How much humiliation do you do? We ran this one photograph. And so, and we had to get the kid's permission. This woman had to go get the permission of the kid. And so we did everything sort of. And so months later, I gave a speech in that area, and I met her and someone else that she was with for dinner. And here's what she told me. She said, what I didn't tell you earlier about when the child came home is this. She was a beautiful child and had just joined the reserves because she wanted to make more money to go to night school or to go to beauty school or whatever they did in those reserve units. You know, these are areas that are straddling lower economic. People in the reserves don't tend to come from, you know, Shaker Heights or Santa Fe. Maybe they do. No, there's a large Hispanic. That's sort of the new wave now. Anyway, and what she did is she began every weekend to get tattooed. And she started getting tattooed all over her body. Large, dark blue, dark black tattoos all over, up through her neck, not on the face, but all over. It was as if she said she wanted to change her skin. So here's what I posit to you. And we're already seeing anecdotal evidence. If you go talk to health commissioners around the country, we're seeing the next generation of dysfunctional people, the Iraqi vets already. They're beginning to see them the doctors who run health programs in major cities will tell you they're beginning to see them incapable of holding a job, babbling in, you know, street people in dire shape. We have not begun to explore the cost of this war in terms, look, let's forget about it in terms of Iraq because it's just an overwhelming. The numbers are catastrophic, and it's a tragedy that. But even back home, it's going to be an awful burden for all of us. We haven't begun to come to terms with any of this in this country. I don't know. When I say this, and we have a president and a vice president that think they would do it again, and they do think that. This is not some act. This is somebody who thinks he's done right. Again, we have not bottom out yet, is what I'm trying to tell you. We have not bottom out yet. And if that doesn't leave you scared, I don't know why, because it sure scares the hell out of me. Amy should come up. I ran about 40 hours too long, but we'll hold you here. Amy, I'm sorry.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Is it true, Cy Hirsch, that Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney attempted to have the FBI break into your house?
It's true that they had this, I was going to get pornographic, they had this dream that they could do it. There are papers in the Jerry Ford Library, and I'll tell you how I learned about it. During the 2000 campaign, Newsweek magazine was doing research in the Ford Library, and they found these documents that were somehow left in the file. It was Rumsfeld and Cheney talking about breaking into my apartment. I had done a story about, our Navy was spying inside Soviet waters, inside the Soviet 12-mile limit. And one sub had gone aground. It was really a crazy program. They used to have, it doesn't matter, it was producing little intelligence with enormous risk, strategic risks to us. Embarrassing to, certainly the Russians knew about it, but no Americans did. And people wanted to kill the program, and I'd written about it. And they were enraged about it, and they wanted to go see what else I knew. They were worried about what else I knew. I think I also got into the idea that we were beginning to intercept Soviet cable communications. I did get into it. And they wrote papers telling the FBI to break in. One of the options, there were options, what to do, do nothing, talk to Hirsch's editors, or just go get break in and see what else he has. And Edward Levy, the late Edward Levy, who was dean of the University of Chicago Law School, wrote back and said, I mean, this was an attorney general in a Republican administration to show you how far we've come in 30 years. He said, are you guys out of your mind? I make that decision. You work in the White House. You can't order the FBI to do that. We have to determine there was a crime, potential crime, have an investigation, have some basis for ordering the FBI into it. None of that threshold has been met. Who are you to do this? It was a blistering letter. And he wrote that letter. It's in the file. And Newsweek never wrote the story. They told me about it. They said they were going to write about it because it said something about Cheney. who was then running for VP. Rumsfeld wasn't on the picture yet. Nobody knew he was going to be the defense secretary. They hadn't talked about it. But it certainly said at that point, it was in the fall of 2000. And they didn't do it. And so I, you know, I have enough grandiosity without writing stories about them trying to break into my apartment, so I never wrote it myself.
Speaking about Dick Cheney, your most recent piece is about Lebanon, mm-hmm. and talking about the United States helping Israel plan the attack. What was the U.S.'s role?
I think it was more than helping. If I was an Israeli, I'd be very mad at the United States. First of all, you have to know something about Israel, and this is not irrational. Hezbollah, for most Israelis, the senior serious Israelis, was a nuisance. There had been, since, if you know, Nasrallah drove him out, took credit, and rightly so. Nasrallah was one of the great terrorists of our time in the 80s. Certainly Hezbollah, I don't think there's much question they were involved in capturing hostages, including the CIA man Buckley, and they were involved in blowing up the American embassy and other things. But that was then and this is now. I would say to you, this is not a brief for Nasrallah, et cetera, but I would say to you that in 20 years from now, some SEAL or Delta Force guy, one of our, who did interrogations, is going to be running for Congress when, you know, and not be talking about what he did with his bare hands on some Iraqi prisoner, you know, in some place, or some other prisoner, Arab prisoner, Islamic prisoner. So people do change over time, and one of the things that happened to Nasrallah is he moved into civil life in Lebanon. There were two, and he got along extremely well with the civilian, particularly the Marinists, the Marinists, which is the group that, out of which came the Falangists back in the 80s, everybody moved he had obtained much more respect inside Lebanon. He was working politically, in the system. He had members of 13 or 11 members of parliament, Lebanese parliament were his, members of his party, two cabinet members, and he was negotiating. He just worked out a huge negotiation, this February with the Maronites, with the Aoun party about sharing power. So it wasn't as if he was some wacko. There had been, after the Israelis were driven out in 2000, there had been a grand total of six Israeli soldiers killed along the border, five in one incident in which Nasrallah said he had nothing to do with. And so the Israelis thing he was doing that many Israelis would tell me, I go to Israel a lot, they're great people, they're a lot of fun. And they are. They're interesting, and there's so much more diversity there than there is here among the Jewish population, as you all know. It's a cliche, but it's true. They would say to me that there were arguments about, among the things he was doing is, some of you may not know, there's 400,000 or 500,000 Palestinian refugees in southern Lebanon in camps, and all they want to do is get to the border and kill an Israeli soldier. He was policing the border. He was keeping the camp people away from the border, and that was something he would, I told you once on air, I talked to him about it. That was something he thought was very important. And so it wasn't as if there was a daily contact. There was a dispute over Shaba Farms. There was some shelling. It had increased a little bit, but basically, the back and forth, it was not a war. It was a static area. So for Israelis, Hezbollah wasn't the existential threat, to use the word that's now become sort of cheapened, existential, that is, was Iran. And the goal, but the American position was, look, Cheney and the president, I don't know who's boss. You know, I just don't know. We don't know. We just don't know. I mean, there's been no real. I mean, I'm sure the president is president. I don't know. Anyway.
What is the joke that President Bush is one heartbeat away from the presidency?
I'll tell you, the real joke is people that think that the Democrats, if they get in office, ought to start an impeachment process. Are you kidding? Look who comes next. Are you going to impeach both of them? I don't know. Anyway. But in any case, so here's the thinking, as I was told. And as I wrote, pretty much, you may have to, some of the words are a little more subtle. The thinking was this. Let's get our Air Force and the Israeli Air Force. The Israeli IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, Israel Defense Force, was run for the first time by an Air Force general named Halutz, who is gung-ho on bombing. just like our Air Force is gung-ho on the efficacy of bombing. You know, bombing is the answer to everything. And, you know, as we know since the strategic bombing survey of World War II, bombing doesn't really change anything. So the idea was that our two Air Forces began to start talking to each other. I hope you understand the cluster bombs. In the last 4 days of the war, the Israelis dropped hundreds, more than 100,000, I've heard numbers many more than that, of cluster bombs in Lebanon, sort of a final act of revenge in the last 3 or 4 days. There was a story in the Times about it the other day.
I think the UN now says a million cluster
bombs.
Well, I
heard 400,000 was the number I heard. Where did those come from? Us. And when did they get shipped? Over a long period of time. So the munition trail started very early on this. I mean, it has to. It's a lot of arms to ship. And, you know, have that many cluster bombs, that many 5,000-pound bunker busters. In any case, so the thinking in the White House was there was a terrific problem in the Joint Chiefs of Staff about hitting Iran because the Air Force had a plan that the other services said is crazy. The other services' position, and you guys in the Air Force always say you could win everything with bombing. You bomb, and then we have to go in and feet, and, you know, put boots on the necks of soldiers and clean up after you, and we can't do it. We don't have the wherewithal. We're done. And so there was a debate going on, a quite active debate going on inside. And so for the White House, for the Israeli Air Force to go and whack Hezbollah and whack their rockets, they're not missiles. Missiles have guidance systems. Most of the long-range weapons in Hezbollah have no guidance systems. They're rockets. Whack them and show what you can do. And then, as an added fillip, have the Israelis go hit the bridges and the infrastructure. And the initial planning called for the initial American push plan, take out the water treatment plants and take out the power plants, not just knock out the power lines, go hit the actual turbines so you really keep them dark. And if you don't do that, at least hold it in as a deterrent. Leave it in reserve and tell Hezbollah if they keep on responding, we're going to hit those plants. I don't know why most people, I'm told by European intelligence, 40 water plants were hit, but I've not seen anything about it. I'm told by a major senior official just last week in Washington, he was telling me that the bombing was more extensive. And so for the White House, it's got a lot of advantages. One, you show the other services, those chicken other Army, Navy, Marine Corps guys, you know, that you show them that bombing can work. Two, you send Iran a message by being almost irrational in what you hit up north. You know, the bridges, all that stuff that really ruined, crippled the lack of morale in Lebanon is acute right now. There's acute depression because nobody cares anymore. We've gone on. We moved on. It's another issue. Three, if you want, Condoleezza Rice in the State Department position was, let's do it because we can improve the status of the senior government. They won't have Hezbollah to fight with. We can improve their status, which, by the way, is not happening. And so, and four, and most importantly, if you're going to bomb Iran, and in the fantasy of the White House world, when it comes to thinking about attacking Iran, you have to hit the known nuclear facilities. As you know, Iran is a signatory to the NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they've declared sites. You hit those sites, so at the minimum, they can't do any work there. Set them back 3-5 years. Plus, you also have to suppress their missiles so they can't hit the oil facilities. You have to suppress their airfield. It gets a lot of targets. And what's the sense of doing that if Nasrallah is sitting there with, you know, thousands of rockets as a deterrent? So by getting rid of that, you take away a deterrent. You make it easier in your thinking. If you want to do Iran, you make it easier because there's a deterrent gone. That's where, look, I wrote it. And it was, a lot of stories I write get an awful lot of attention. This is a story that was like, wow, all over the world, yes, tremendous attention. It's lonely at the top, and I'm not complaining. But the New York Times and the Washington Post, not a word anywhere suggesting that the Israeli attack on Hezbollah, which led to horrific consequences for Israel, may have had something to do with Washington thinking. Not even just whether or not Washington pushed it, which I believe they did. If I'm an Israeli, I'd be so mad at us right now for pushing us into this war that's really been devastating for them. And as I said, as Nasrallah talk is saying, could be the beginning of a whole new wave of collective action on the Palestinian and Gaza problem, about which, as you know, the Israelis have been just whacking away in there. Anyway, long answer to a short question.
We're about to hit the 20th anniversary of the Iran-Contra scandal. The role of Elliot Abrams and Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, I mean, today or then?
today, with Lebanon and Washington interests.
I can just tell you, I had lunch with in Virginia with a guy in the community, a heavy player, and we began. And he's going to retire, so he began by saying to me, "I have a lot of lunches with people. You know, I don't take a notebook sometimes." And he began by saying, "You've got to get Abrams. You've got to get Abrams. Abrams is, as you know, a cult existed before, a cabal, if you will, Ali North in the Iran-Contra. That was a small group of men that changed policy. They traded, you know, they sold weapons via Israel to the Iranians for more money than they were worth, and took the money and spread it to support the war, the murderous war they ran. And the extent of murder we committed in that war in Central America is not known to most Americans.
Nicaragua,
yes. It was just devastating. There was some horrific, there was some horrific events that took place that weren't reported. But anyway, and so basically, if you look, I think Abrams is terribly important in the thinking and planning about what's going to happen in Iran, if it does happen. I think he was very instrumental on the planning and coordination for the Israeli operation.
And his position?
He's a special advisor to the President of the National Security Council, he's a deputy to the President on National Security Affairs. He's also a deputy to Steve Hadley. He doesn't work for Rumsfeld directly. But I think right now it's fair to say there's been some reporting on it, and it's not 100% clear. It's fair to say that the Pentagon, Rumsfeld, and certainly the Vice President's office has set up a separate chain of reporting on Iran and what's going on there, and on Hezbollah that comes directly into the White House, perhaps through the Defense Intelligence Agency, but not through the CIA. The CIA is really cut out of the game right now. And the CIA, I must tell you, I have no brief for the CIA. I've written, as anybody who follows me know, I've written horrific stories about them and the abuses that they've done. But when it comes to intelligence reporting, their analysts are very good, and they've been completely frozen out by this administration. This administration, at one point, I think it's safe to say, at one point, senior people believe that the CIA were working actively with Kerry to defeat them. I mean, they're really off the wall, these guys. It's hard to believe it. But there's a lot of anecdotal, you know, it's again one of those stories. It's hard to write stories when everybody's going to deny it. And nobody, you know, I've got, and other reporters can't. What I get from, you know, I worked for the New York Times for 7-8 years. I did, you know, all kinds of stories about Kissinger and spying. And so I know what the New York Times does and what it takes to make a story. And I, you know, and the standards at the New Yorker are so far beyond those at the Times. I always wonder how I could have written a story without the kind of backup I have at the New Yorker. And so when they don't run a story and my friends call up and they say, well, we can't find anybody that's going to confirm it. You know, we can't find anybody to talk to me about what you said. So therefore, we're not going to report it. That's like, you know, I don't know what Jefferson would say about it.
When we look at the press today and you look up, you look at what's happening with Iran, and you're saying that they don't have the nuclear weapons. Are we seeing an exact reprise of the lead-up to the invasion with Iraq? I mean, you have the media now hand-wringing, how did we get it so wrong, accepting that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Yet you say, with the information you have, with the pieces you're writing, that almost the same scenario.
I quoted somebody in the New Yorker. He said, "This is son of Iraq. I wish I could have identified this person. He's still inside. He's in a very special place, and I couldn't. I describe him as a senior person familiar with all of the intelligence. This is son of Iraq. And yes, is there a learning curve? Oh, let me give you some news, Amy. We don't learn from the past in America. I don't want to break your heart.
This still the present?
It's still the present. I always, you know, I'm one of those people who tried back in the Vietnam War because I knew Bernard Fall and I knew I.F. Stone and I knew these people in 65. And so I began to do the kind of reading that a lot of people just didn't do about the war. And one of the things I learned very quickly is, hey, wait a second. Johnson says, we got to fight the Vietnamese to stop the Chinese from coming. It's, you know, the domino effect. But wait a second. Vietnam and China have fought each other forever. They hate each other. And, you know, 4 years after the war, Vietnam War ended in 75 and 79, Vietnam and China had a war. You know, I mean, big deal. There's no history. There's no history in America. Does anybody in the, you know, Woodward did a book. Here's my take on that. He did a book called Plan of, it was very useful because he was given enormous access, Bob Woodward. And I have a disagreement with Bob Woodward, but he doesn't get things wrong. Bob gets things, you know, we have a disagreement. He likes top down, I like bottom up. But he doesn't get, he works hard and he got access to the minutes of 58 National Security Council meetings. And I'm sure they were vetted to a degree, but not to that much of a degree. He got a lot of sensitive, you know, he's a trusted guy. So he wrote this book about the plan of attack that's been a resource tool for a lot of people. I mean, for me too. And it's all about the build up to the war, 18 months between 9/11 and the invasion of my 9/11 fall of September of 2001 and March of 2003. And it's all about these meetings discussing about how do we go to war, the president, the vice president. Mostly it was with what they call the principals. That's the National Security Council without the president, Cheney running it. And he's got verbatim transcripts back and forth. And I read it, and about 6 months after I read it, it's one of these, it's like reading a denouement in some, you know, some good mystery. Henning Mankell, he always does it, the Swedish writer. He always has these, a line on page 22 pays off on page 300. I suddenly said, oh my God, you know what's missing in this? Here's the minutes of all the meetings. I'm talking about planning for the war. And at no time does Cheney or the president say, so, guys, what's this Koran stuff? Can somebody give me a two-page memo on it? And Islamists, and what? It's all about these guys want what we have, and that's why they're doing it. They want what we have, and you know we've got to show them how democracy works. There's not any intellectual curiosity in these documents about who they are. I mean, they're talking to Bernard Lewis, of course, who you know sees him. I'm exaggerating only slightly. The late Bernard Lewis stuff is. It seems to me he concludes that Arabs are somewhat subhuman. You know, he did a piece a month ago in the Wall Street Journal in which he said, mutual assured, the reason you can't let Iran have a bomb, assuming they have one, is they would be irrational and they would use it against Israel even if it meant their death because they're not rational. Okay. Wow. Anyway.
You wrote a book about Israel.
The Samson option, yeah.
The Samson option about nuclear weapons, about Mordechai Vanunu, what happened to him, about right. The press complicity with the Israeli government in Britain to capture him.
Right.
Can you tell that story?
Oh, well, the thing about that book that was interesting was, I wrote a book called The Samson Option. It was about how America looked the other way and abetted Israel getting a bomb. I didn't make a judgment. I was sort of careful about it. I didn't want to make a judgment. Israel would want to make a bomb, but with American help, at the same time we're trying to tell the rest of the world, you can't proliferate. We're turning a blind. So that was the thesis of the book, which is that, you know, it's madness. We were doing something insane. And what happened, of course, is that, what's his name, the British publisher who committed suicide or died right afterward.
Robert Maxwell.
I had a chapter in there about Maxwell had helped the Israelis capture Vanunu by offering him a lot of money to serialize his story. Vanunu was trying to, he had an agent who was trying to sell it, and one London paper was going to buy it, and Maxwell offered maybe more money or a different venue, and they arranged to have Vanunu meet people, and then Maxwell tipped off the Israelis, and he was acting as an Israeli agent, although he wasn't an agent, he just was acting as, he wasn't a per se agent as somebody, he wasn't in the employee, he just was.
You said Nicholas Davies, his foreign editor, may well have worked for the Mossad.
I don't remember, but Nicholas Davies was certainly closer to, you know, he was on the take, or at least, I shouldn't say that, but I don't remember exactly what I wrote. But he was certainly, the foreign editor was deeply, much more deeply involved in the recruitment. He was the one who set it up, and he had very close ties to the Israelis, and was also in the process, what I remember writing, that he was trying to sell arms on the side to the Israelis. That's what he was doing. The foreign editor of Maxwell's
The Daily paper, Mirror?
Of the Mirror. At the time, he was involved in an arms deal with a guy named Ari Ben-Menashe. It was all, and there was paper trail on it. Just paper. It wasn't something vague. I remember getting to Davis's ex-wife, which is always not a nice thing to do. You know, I would basically tell anybody, I would generally say, if you wanted my professional opinion about dealing with reporters, is I would say, you know, be careful. Well, you know, what, I could tell this story about tracking down Maxwell in this story, I could tell it in a way that makes me virtuous, and I could tell it in a way that makes me sleazy. I could say I went and found his ex-wife and got her not only just to talk to me, but to go and look through papers for me, you know, papers from their relationship. And, of course, it was, ex-wife equals unhappiness. And so it's something we do, you know. We're not adverse to that. And so there's no...
And speaking of women, didn't the Israeli Mossad use a woman to lure
they used
Mordechai
a woman. They used poor Venu, they used a woman who he thought fell in love with him, and that's how they took him away. They got him on a plane to Rome, I think. He was going to fly away with her, and they drugged him, and they broke every law there was.
Would you call it the first extraordinary rendition?
Oh, I'm sure there were others. I'm sure there have been others. I think rendition is... I hate that word. What I call it is going into someone's house and grabbing them by the hair in the middle of the night and pulling them out, drugging them, and throwing them in a plane, coming in illegally, unmarked. What we do is we go into a country in an unmarked chopper, fly into an airbase in coordination with the local police that we pay off. We go in without any identification. Our men are masked and wearing, unmarked by the dark clothes. There's no signatures, no insignia. Go into a house, grab somebody by the hair, pull them out, and drug them and take them off to some place to torture them. In Vietnam, we had the Phoenix program, which by William Kobe, the former head of the CIA, testified 20,000 Vietnamese were killed, with the Americans going in, grabbing people by the hair and pulling them out. This is not new to us. The thing about war, what's his name? Not Sassoon. Paul Fussell, who teaches at Yale, has written a couple of books about war and about propaganda. We have no concept of war. We're not even seeing it now. We're still seeing it through a filter. It's better now than it was. In World War II, there was censorship. We weren't allowed to see the pictures of our mutilated boys, our soldiers. It was bad for morale. And Fussell wrote a book about it. And why somebody in the United States, in a position of leadership, can't make a moral stand on what we've done in Iraq, the destruction of a society that had a symphony orchestra, that had great hospitals, that had an enormous culture, that was, in the Arab world, it was considered the cleanest city. And it was had a reputation for being the cleanest city, just in terms of straight, garbage pickup and other stuff like that. The cleanest city. Other Arabs would talk about it. Why it's unremarked, why this president, when three-year-olds in a nursery school fight, the nursery school teacher takes the two little boys and grabs them by their hair, pulls them apart, and says, you two shake hands and go back in the sandbox, talk to each other and say you're sorry and go back. Why the president of the United States is allowed not to talk to the Iranian leadership, not to talk to the Syrian leadership, not to talk to the North Korean, that he can sit there and say, I'm not talking to them, and think it's a virtue. And why we aren't more, why this isn't a huge public issue for us. It's just baffling to me.
You said this.
Well, that's not an applause line.
You said in one of your earlier pieces that Bashar al-Assad made overtures to the U.S.
Constantly.
After 9/11.
He did more than that. Bashar Assad, I'll tell you some facts that are hard to know, hard to guess, but Nasrallah, traditionally, was one of the most vigorous critics of al-Qaeda. The al-Qaeda terrorism, he's a Sunni Shia, yes. It could be, it was simply a question. There was enormous contempt for al-Qaeda. The Nasrallah role is, we're fighting the Israelis, you're killing women and children. Who are you? Get out of here. Don't come and tag on the end of our war with some statement. There were really a lot of hostility. In Syria, there was long-standing, his father, Assad, Bashar Assad, his father, old man Assad, were violently opposed to jihadism, extremely opposed, and also the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been plotting for the overthrow. It's an Alawite kingdom. It's a sort of a spin-off of a Shia, it's a small sect. Only 11% of the country in Syria are Alawite, and yet they rule, they control much. So there's a lot of Shia-Sunni opposition and radical opposition, and they would stomp it out. And they had files galore after 9/11. the CIA learned more about the Muslim Brotherhood, which was very closely, almost entwined with Al-Qaeda in Munich, we know, in Spain, we know, and other places. They turned over thousands of files. And I've seen Bashar a couple of times, and he has bitterly complained. He said, I send letters to the President of the United States, and he does not even acknowledge them. And he said, what? Everybody, you know, I send letters saying we must have contact. We must talk. There are issues to discuss. And I will tell you now that, again, this is one of those stories that I've been told and I wasn't able to firmly, but I have a lot of reason to think there's a basis for it. I think in 03, the Israelis were interested in talking to Bashar about and even the Golan Heights, and the White House was very much against it. And I hear again, Peretz publicly, the defense minister, has publicly said in the wake of the fiasco in southern Lebanon, he's publicly said we should begin talks with Syria. And I'm sure, again, the White House has been very, in fact, I've been told the White House is very scathing about it.
You mentioned the Democrats not offering an option. The person talked about as a front runner, Hillary Rodham Clinton, her position. Kerry and Edwards have, at this point, not before the election, but at this point, said that they were wrong to have endorsed the invasion. Hillary Rodham Clinton has yet to say this.
Well, she's too busy defending his reputation, too. She has. I mean, look, I'm not a Hillary fan, so let's leave it at that. You know, I just think. Forget her. The guy that gets me is him. Because he has not said one word in opposition to this war, direct opposition. He's been on the sides, he's been on the margins. He has not publicly taken a strong stand against the war. A war that we have every reason to believe he has the same contempt any rational person would, and he sees it as non-productive. He is not to protect her or whether. And this is an incredible failure of the leadership. It's sad. It's a sad. We're in a sad place politically in America. We will muddle through because I think the Europeans. You can make the argument that you have the guy in Venezuela, and you have the guy in Iran. Because who's going to stand up to us? Europe has failed totally. You can make the argument that the leadership in Europe has not been able to rein in George Bush, and certainly, it's been a tragic failure of leadership around the world that they haven't been able to seriously make a dent. So if you're in the third world, you have to try and go around it. You have to figure out some strategic way to work. If you're thinking the big picture, and I think they do think the big picture, I do think they think about the world in 10 years.
Do you think the U.S. will attack Iran? You said in this piece that was back in April that they could use bunker buster tactical nuclear weapons.
Well, it doesn't matter what I think. Because it's I'm stuck in a position here, Amy, with you, because I'm still boy reporter. And so I'm writing more about it. I'm only doing Iran. I'm not doing anything else, really. It doesn't really matter what I think. What matters is what's happening inside the government. I certainly don't think anything will happen. There's no October surprise. I mean, this, the kind of, if they do it, the kind of operation they would take would involve the serious realignment of assets. And you have some serious problems in Iran. And I've written about the fact that, the Republican, when the Shah fell and Khomeini came in, for a long time the Republican Guards in Iran, they made a living smuggling. Smuggling was a big thing, and the ports on the Gulf, and in the Straits of Hormuz, where that's Iran controls the Straits. It's only a 20-mile area where 40% of the world's oil passes every day, or something like that. 40 is it? Could be 40 or 60, something like that. Some huge number. Well, the Republican Guards, they have little Boston Whalers, little boats they've used for smuggling. And I can tell you right now, enormous concern would be that you're looking at, there's 800 to 1,000 of them, we estimate, 700 ports, little ports that we have identified, 700 ports along the Gulf, along the waterway. And so you're looking at 1,000 potential suicide boat bombers. And that's an enormous strategic issue. That they could send, 800 boats out full of TNT to do what car bombs do in Baghdad. And that's not an inconsiderable issue. So there's a lot of complicated things. And so it doesn't matter what I think right now. I also think that If you really think about it, if you're thinking about attacking Iran, you have to say, what's going to happen in Venezuela? Will he pull his oil off the market? And in support of Iran, he sells 2 million barrels a day to American companies. And if he does stop selling to American companies, what's the legal implications of that? Would we have the right to move in and nationalize the companies, grab the companies? I mean, I can tell you this kind of talk and thinking is going on in certain circles in Washington. And then I'm just taking it to another level of total fear-mongering, but that's where we're at.
When Chavez went to the UN and called President Bush a devil, that was repeated over and over again in the U.S. media. What wasn't mentioned at all in the corporate media as a follow-up to that was that President Bush said it first. He talked about the axis of evil.
Yeah, but, you know, this isn't Plato's Republic. And so to expect anything else is, you know, I mean, that's, you know, that's, don't expect anything else. For example, as I said there about Nasrallah, it's really scary to me that the media does not report. He's given now 5 or 6 major speeches. And he gives serious speeches that say serious thing, and he's not being demagogic. I'm not a big supporter of what he said at the UN. I think the beautiful thing about the UN. I thought, by the way, you notice the Israelis were very angry that Ahmadinejad was allowed to talk at the UN. They made a big point of how can we allow him, and I think that's what the UN's all about. So it is a place to talk about and raise discussions. And it is, that's the important function there. And I thought his language was wrong. I thought he could have said it without using the words, let Bush be the one who says that. That's what I would say.
Last question is, what gives you hope as you're following Iran right now? You see what has happened in Iran.
Well, because I'm in the country a lot, like you are, and you see, and I the response to you is really growing by leaps and bounds. I have to keep on telling you, I hear more and more people listen to your show because of disillusion with other media, and also because they get a sense of they're getting something straight and something different. And so you see more interest and more activity, more response to you, do you not? And so I see the same thing. I see that, you know, this isn't 1970 and we don't have Kent State and we don't have a draft and we don't have 58,000 dead. We don't have the bodies coming back in the numbers. We also have a Praetorian Guard. We don't have the upper class and upper middle class being hit by casualties among them. And we really have a paid army and largely, as I say, a lot of minorities involved, which is, but there is I don't think Milei ended the war. I think what it did is it made it harder for him to rally middle America. And I actually think the issue that broke it for him was in May of 2 years later after the story, a year and a half after the story, May of 2001, May of 1971 in Fort Benning, Georgia, a jury of Callie's peers found him guilty of mass murder. When he was found guilty, that was it for Nixon. He couldn't raise America again on the war. That was the beginning. I thought then was the time that killed it. And I'm not saying that to be, it's not modesty because I don't have much of it. And so I thought that was the critical issue. And so here, we're coming to, the stupid word tipping point, but we're coming to a point, I don't think Bush can sell it anymore. I think he's getting to a point where he can't sell it anymore. Doesn't make him less dangerous because it doesn't matter what happens after the elections. In Chicago, where I grew up, the phrase used to be, he doesn't give a rat's ass about it. I don't think he's profoundly interested in this election. I have some anecdotal reason for saying it, but it's not empirical. I think he's going through the motions.
Why doesn't he care?
Because I think he's got an agenda that's going to, whether the Democrats have one house or not, I think he's going to do it.
And the agenda is?
It's about what I think. I think he's got an agenda, but I'm not clear what it is. I don't think it's good for America. I think he believes in democracy, and the fact that I don't think he sees any contradiction in trying to they're doing terrible stuff now to derail Hamas. There's much more going on covertly. We're doing much more to undermine Hamas than the public knows about. A lot of crap going on that we're doing with Fatah and other people. We're always into this stuff. And that's when you ask me about Elliot Abram. That's where he's at anyway. And so the point being that I think there is a neocon, if you will, agenda that may have a lot of religious roots. And I think the next year is going to be a really telling year for him. I don't think there's going to be much restraint on him.
On ending on a moment of hope, one of the things I see going around the country are the number of soldiers who are coming back or not going at all. Just in the last day, another soldier has refused to redeploy. He went AWOL. He's turned himself in at Fort Irwin in Camp Irwin in California. In My Lai, if you could end with this story. Yes, there was Cali. There was mass murder. But there were also some soldiers who said no. Can you tell us
about
that?
Well, what they did, as I said casually, incidentally, they shot high. They did not shoot. Because, as I said, you would get, you know, there's a lot of bad stuff going on in that war. I mean, young officers are coming out of West Point and saying to the boys, there'll be no more dope smoking, and then they would get bombed the next day or shot in the back. After I did My Lai, I got a bunch of letters from some Navy surgeons in Japan, and they said, you've got to come and do this. We're seeing catastrophic bullet wounds in young second lieutenants in their back, one after another. They're being shot in the back by their own soldiers because they were trying to advocate stuff. So you had an enormous dissent, and you know, there's been a movie, and you've been talking about it a lot on your show, and you did specials on the documentary about the boys who didn't fight. I still think this is a different world and a different era, and the troops aren't druggies like they were. You know, they give a lot of them those sleeping pills. What's the sleeping pill that you use when you take an airplane? Ambien. Some of these doctors are giving 2 or 3 Ambien a night to the kids to get through because they're having such terrible times over there. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of unintended consequences of those drugs that people don't really know very well. There's a lot of stuff reported of whatever the word is, counterindications, I guess, is the medical word. Anyway, the real issue was, you could argue at a more sophisticated level, will there be a serious high level objection at the Joint Chiefs or somewhere else? I saw once an email from inside a high level of the government to show you the kind of thinking that does go on, which is really, in a way, interesting and hopeful. It was just an internal email, and some very bright guy was talking about where we were. If we go into Iran, the consequences for Iraq are catastrophic. Among other things, we have delegated thousands of soldiers to various Iraqi units, many of them Shia units, are controlled by militias. They're all terribly vulnerable like this. You know, they could be killed overnight. And also, you could argue that you can expect any day that there could be a mass wave attack. I still think it's possible on our green zone, known to the CIA as Emerald City. That's what they call it. Our green zone, where you could see a major sort of Tet-like attack. You could see something catastrophic taking place. And so this memo, the last paragraph, this officer said, he was a memo written for others. He said, well, I think what we should do is just, let's take a mulligan. If you don't know, mulligan in golf is, Clinton knows what it is. You take an extra shot. Let's just say we want a mulligan. Let's just say we're really, really, really sorry we ever started this, and we really, 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 really are. Let's tell Saddam, come on back, run the country. You can start going to prayer meetings with the president. Tell Halliburton they can have all the contracts they want, and let's just figure out some way out of this mess, because we don't have a way out. The real dilemma you have is an interesting military one, where you may see more disaffection, not only from troops, but from senior people, and I wish some would speak out. There's no end game. They don't know how to get out. Guys are thinking, what am I going to do? You can't drive an armored personnel car north into Kurdistan and then into Turkey, which that's one way. They may just drive cars. But I can tell you, if you think you're going to do an evacuation driving 200 miles into Kuwait and Jordan across Shia-controlled territory, you're kidding yourself. And if you think, right now we're being resupplied by trucks largely, and if you think that they can't stop a truck anytime they want, the Shia opposition, they can't blow up our trucks and stop the water and the petrol from getting through. They can. So we're in a situation where we have absolutely no control. And I'll tell you something else I know anecdotally about this war. The trucks go because they're so frightened. Our convoys go at night with no lights. And they go 70, 80 miles an hour. And in Iraq, there's a few major highways, and villages are built along it. That's how they are. The villages are built along, they straddle highways. You get populated areas every, you know, couple dozen miles. There's long stretches of nothing. Then you get populated areas, particularly as you get closer into the central part of the country and towards Baghdad. And there's no electricity at all, certainly not for streetlights at night. So there's no streetlights. And if the wind's blowing the wrong way, every night they're running down people. Every night they're running people down on the street. And it's driving them crazy, the convoy people. They're running down people because they go 80 miles an hour as fast as they can. Anybody in their way is just run down. And if the wind's blowing the wrong way, you can't hear. And there's a lot of wind in the desert. And they're going through these villages, and clunk, there goes another one. You know, in the Vietnam War, I was once, at some point when I was right after My Lai, I had to give a speech in New Orleans. And the New Orleans Times-Picayune, I was speaking with McGovern, ran a editorial on the front page in pink for communists, red, attacking me coming there. And so, naturally, I was speaking at what's that school? In Tulane, I guess. It wasn't LSU, which was in Baton Rouge. It was in New Orleans. It was Tulane. And they had to move it from an auditorium into a basketball stadium. Half of it, close off half of it. There was so many people came because... And so, this was at a time of a lot of VVAW. There was a lot of anti-war sentiment, and the kids used to wear their clothes, and there was really, there is a great history to be done about the impact of the Vietnam dissent on the soldiers and on the officers. It was devastating. And so, I got out there, and I just winged this. I went out there and I said, a lot of vets here, anybody from Chulai, anybody served 98 up north in Chulai province, aviation unit. Come on, hands. Anybody in, I named the unit. Anybody in 180, it was a big aviation unit up there, up in north, and four or five hands. I said, come on, anyone here, come up here. And so one guy came up, got on stage. This was nasty, but I did it. Because it's hard to communicate to the public. I always tell that story about killing the kid with one because, you know, screw you, I had to go through it. You know, that's part of it. You know, you should know it. You should know this is what goes on. So this kid gets up there, and he's a nice kid. And I said, what'd you do? And he said, I was a door gunner, and Apaches, and I flew. And so I had some bad missions. Yeah. Tell me about one. Well, we'd go, and what they would do often is the American boys and our allies, the Vietnamese, but mostly American boys would get shot up, and these choppers would come, and they would throw the bodies in there. And they would have to take the bodies back, and then they would dump off the bodies, and then at a hospital or at a morgue, and then they would fly back to the unit. And so when you would fly back, you'd be in a bed, afraid of mine. Yeah, yeah. So what would happen if you passed over a field with farmers in it? He said, what do you mean? I said, what would you do? I said, in July this year, this unit, what did you guys do regularly? Well, I didn't do it, but what did you hear guys did? Well, we'd sort of have a little fun with them. I said, well, what'd you do? Well, we'd fly low over the farmers. And at the right time, when they were running like hell, we'd tip them and try and decapitate them with the rotor. And we'd fly them off, and we'd get them with the rotor on the way home. We'd just go find some farmers, and we'd just tilt the wheel and get them. And then what would happen? I didn't do it, but tell me what you heard. Well, he said, then we'd go back, and I said, what'd you do when you get back? I mean, did you go right to the base? No, no, no. I said, he said, you'd have to stop outside the base and wash off the chopper. And then you go back. What do you do with this? What do you do with this?
What did you do with it?
Well, I mean, you know, what can you do with it? Not much. What am I going to do? Write a story about kids I know that did it. Do you know how many people talked to me after I did Abu Ghraib about what they saw and what they did? Do you know how many things went on that war? You're going through a village and... Are they all going to go to jail? Am I going to write stories about every one of them? Are they all going to be put in jail for what they did? They go through a village, and you're in groups of three. And the way the army does it, they go through the village, and they stagger the time. But they always go through the village every day on a patrol. And they have Bradley's army vehicles. And in the back of the vehicles, 6-8 men sit there, and they'll go through, and there'll be kids, and they'll throw candy to kids, and the kids and the woman will cheer, and you say something to them as they go through a village, and 100 feet farther on, IED, an unexploded, those bombs triggered by remote control will go off, and the first vehicle will get blown up, and 7 of their buddies are either killed or wounded, and the other 2 guys come out of the other 2 units, gun blazing, and anybody moving, they're going to shoot. And in one case, and you know, everybody now has these damn little cameras. You know, I actually got a new phone, and I paid more to get one without a camera. But anyway, probably because of this. I don't know why. And the kids all have cameras, and they've learned not to open them up like this so nobody sees what they're doing. So the pictures are sometimes hip high. And in this one case, somebody sent me a lot of footage on. They jumped out. They saw a bunch of people moving in a field, and they opened fire. It was a soccer game. So they didn't know what to do. So they dragged the bodies together, and you could see big boots walking, and they dropped cannons and RPG rounds around them. And they called it in as killing insurgents and went on. And one of the kids told me a lot about it. Didn't want to rat out his friends. Doesn't want to go to jail. What do you do with it? Do I go... I did a little bit with it. Do I go write a story about them and they all go to jail? Do you understand how much of this goes on? It goes on. It's war. And what I ended up thinking about My Lai, and in the end, I wanted to hate Callie. When I first met Callie, it was I had to look for him for a long, it was very hard to find Callie. He was hidden. I learned about him. I knew about him. And I wanted to hate him so much. When I found him, he weighed 135. He dropped out of a junior college near Miami, and he'd gone to work for a Florida and some other city railroad. And he worked 4 days, and the first night he was alone, missed the switch, and 2 trains collided, and he was fired, and he went in the army. And they got 90 days of training, became an officer with just junior college education, was put in charge of a group of men. There was a big show then, it was called Hawaii 5-Over. 5-0. The kids that worked for him called him Hawaii 4.5. Because they knew how incompetent he was. And so I was ready to hate him, right? And even though I knew about him, he's 135. He's got skin so thin you could see his veins. He's scared to death. He knows I'm the last person reporter he's going to talk to in a long time. He first starts telling me how tough it was. And at one point, he's hidden. I'm in some room with him in a base that he's hidden on. And he goes, offers me a beer, and he takes a beer, and he goes to the bathroom. He says he has to go urinate, and I see him throw up arterial blood. He's got an ulcer this big, right? And so you end up talking to these kids, and you get their stories, and I swear the last paragraph, or the last sentence of the book I wrote about My Lai, a book called My Lai 4, said they were as much of a victims as the people they executed. And that's a reality. And so what's coming home is bad stuff. What we've left there is bad stuff. And the kind of stories, I mean, I'm only touching the surface about what I heard. This is what we do. It's a war where you don't see an enemy in a uniform. The chaos that we've created, the misery we've caused to that society. You think this is an Al-Qaeda-sponsored war? Let me assure you, it generates from what we've done. We've triggered the insurgency.
Well, I'd like to end on a
positive. So that's hopeful. Do you want a hopeful note?
I'd like to end on a positive note. But all I'll say is this is a discussion in a time of war. The rest is up to you. Thank you very much.
No problem.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.